The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Wednesday, December 18th. But, of course, you're listening to it anytime since it's a podcast. And we are streaming live, right, Dee?
Yes, we are. How's it going, everybody?
On the YouTube. So this is a big deal. We like doing this from time to time when we have really compelling guests. Well, we like doing it even when our guests aren't as compelling as the one we have now.
Oh.
As we do all the time, a bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show, I ask my distinguished guest, compelling or not, to introduce him or herself. Distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Carlos Ramirez Rosa, Alderman of the 35th Ward, Chicago Northwest Side.
That's correct.
Thank you, Bob Mueller. And the beautiful thing about Carlos Ramirez Rosa, we can do a deep dive on local issues because obviously he's an alderman. Is there still a progressive? I was going to say member of the Progressive Caucus. there's more like the Democratic Socialist Caucus. He's like in three. You're like three caucuses, aren't you?
I'm in four.
Okay, let me see if I can do it. Latino caucus, which I'll ask you about because they tried to kick you out of that. I remember
they
writing
did.
About
now
it.
Now I'm the vice chair of the caucus. A lot has changed.
This freaking city, man. I can't keep up. And the guy that tried to kick you out is no longer in the city council. Oh boy, Rick.
Yeah.
So Latino caucus, progressive caucus, the commie caucus, just kidding. Democratic Socialist caucus.
That's right.
Just
yes.
Kidding.
Socialist caucus. We left the Democratic out of that one.
Okay. Just to be
just
clear.
Just too much of a mouthful, you know.
What's the fourth caucus?
Gay caucus. LGBT caucus.
There's how many members of that?
We got five.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Who are the five members?
So we got Tom Tunney,
uh-huh.
Lakeview. We got James Kappelman, Uptown. We got Maria Haddon, Rogers Park.
Yeah.
Myself and Raymond Lopez on the southwest side.
Raymond Lopez, 15th Ward Alderman, a frequent guest on the Ben Jarofsky Show. Maria Haddon's been on the show. The Capster's never been on my show. I could see that there's no ideological unity abiding of that caucus, that's for sure. Ideologically, that caucus is all over the map.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we come together like any type of identity affinity caucus to focus on issues connected to that group of people. And so one of the things that we've done is we've worked to advance trans rights at the city of Chicago level. We ensured that the city of Chicago had a bathroom access ordinance that respected trans people. And so essentially now you can go into the bathroom that you feel most comfortable entering, mm-hmm. regardless of what's on your ID.
I'm going to sound, I told you, Carlos, before every show, I always go over my guests, what we're going to talk about. And then we go on tangents. We never mm-hmm. get into any of it. When I was in Los Angeles visiting my daughter, or daughters, I should say, over Thanksgiving, I went to my first non-gender bathroom. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to
we have gender neutral bathrooms in my office.
Man, see, I didn't know that. your office at in the ward or
yeah,
the
2934
city?
North Milwaukee.
Man,
Avenue.
Was a shock to this old geezer. I walk yeah. in and it says there's a sign that says urinals this way. And then the other way where there are all the stalls, it's just men and women. And, you know, I'm like, hey, man, this is L.A., okay? It's yeah. not Chicago anymore.
Well, and so technically, every bathroom in the city of Chicago technically mm-hmm. is now a gender neutral bathroom, because even though you go to the restaurant and it says women on the door, if you as a person identify as a woman, feel more comfortable entering and using that bathroom under the city's ordinance, you will have the right to do that.
I see. Okay. This one was just like, that's the way it is. And
I will say a lot of the bars, obviously, in Boys Town have been quicker to adopt this gender neutral. And I get complaints now from a lot of my female friends. They're like, we used to have the cleanest bathrooms.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's Dennis's fault. All right. And I had a whole bunch of things I want to talk to you about on the local level. And we're going to get to them all. But as I sat down here right before the show, the word broke that an appellate court, I don't know where it was. I just saw the headline in the first paragraph, folks. So we'll fill in the details as time goes on. But this is the bottom line. Appellate court concurred with a lower court's decision, a judge in Texas decision, to throw out Obamacare. And, folks, I'm telling you right now, we talk a lot about impeachment on this show, Carlos. We talk a lot about whether swing voters in Michigan, you know, are going to go for Trump, or are they going to be nervous and not vote for Bernie, or Elizabeth Warren or lefty is elected. Folks, you are insane if you allow this to continue. You cannot have, in my humble opinion, Carlos, you cannot have a civilized society without health care.
Right.
And they've just thrown, the Republicans have been fighting Obamacare since the moment. And it's, Obamacare is diluted anyway.
That's right.
It's not even what, like, civilized countries. They've been fighting it from the moment Obama twisted enough Democratic arms to pass it. You were just out of high school. This is how long this has been going on. And they're on the precipice of having a judge throw it out. I'm sure the flunkies in the Supreme, well, I'm not, I don't know which way Roberts will go on that one, but you know, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, Donald Trump's flunkies in the Supreme Court, are going to be for. It's insane. Am I right in saying?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this started right after Obamacare went into effect. We saw Republican governors and Republican lawmakers in states in the South, across the nation, refused to engage in Obama's Medicaid expansion, which tremendously helped so many working people in the state of Illinois, in other states where they took advantage of that Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. And so that was really the first attempt by Republicans to undo Obamacare. But to your point, Obamacare, one, is not a single payer system. It's not a universal healthcare system like the ones that we see with the National Healthcare Service in England. It's really just a mandate, right, that everyone has to purchase one of these options on the market. And depending on what your income is, you know, if you're a lower income person, you're going to receive some assistance. Obviously, it's tremendous. It's helped tremendously a lot of people get access to healthcare. The options are still not good, unfortunately. So it definitely is not what we want it to be. But Obamacare was the Republican solution for health insurance and health care in the 70s. And now suddenly it's socialized medicine, which it's totally not.
It is totally not. And I know we'll probably come back to this when we get into the national political discussion. I didn't even mean to lead with this, but I just saw this story breaking and it just set off all the alarms. I feel that if this country reelects Donald Trump, knowing, and they go, folks, you know this, don't be stupid, America, okay? You know this. He's going to throw out Obamacare. They're already, the Trump administration has joined the case against Obamacare. Right now, your tax dollars are paying lawyers on the federal level to destroy Obamacare. Just like your local property taxes paid lawyers in the city of Chicago to destroy the lawsuit against Lincoln Yards. Just had to throw that out there. If America still votes for Donald Trump, that is just an act of masochism. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, it's self-destructive.
Yeah. I mean, people really don't understand what's at risk here. And I think that so much of what is going to impact their daily lives, what is impacting their daily lives, is filtered through the discourse in Fox News, in the national media. And so we need a candidate like Bernie Sanders. We need a movement that really spells out to working people, these are the bread and butter issues. This is how Trump and the Republicans and their policies have hurt you. These are how our policies will benefit you, your family, your neighbors, your children, generations to come.
Yeah. By the way, I just want to, before we move on, you're an alderman now, and I presume you have health care through the city, correct?
I do.
Before you were elected, were you on Obamacare?
For a brief period of time, I did buy an option on the market. But prior to that, obviously, I had health insurance through my university, right? And then I was a congressional staffer, which was not the best health insurance, I can tell you that. And then after being a congressional staffer, I had a good union job as a deportation defense organizer with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights.
So, man, God bless the unions. All right, let's move to some local stuff, and we'll come back to the nationals. Today was a city council meeting, and you were a good sport to come here after the city council meeting, and you were bringing all kinds of goodies. What is Christmas Day at the Chicago City
That's
Council?
Right. So it's the last meeting before we break for the holidays. And so traditionally, aldermen will purchase each other gifts, which is totally ethical as long as it's unsolicited and beneath the value of $50.
I wouldn't even think that it was unethical, but whatever.
So I can't make out who bought this, but someone got some Bridgeport coffee. Oh, it's from Patrick Daly Thompson.
Who's the alderman of the 11th ward.
Bridgeport coffee, Bubbly Creek, Big Body Sweet, and Berry. So that's something right there. Ana Valencia got us some Frango mints, very Chicago, of our Chicago clerk. And then there's this mug, which I want you to have this mug. It's from Alderman Walter Burnett and his son, who's now the state representative of that area.
So. All right. Thank you very much.
Aww, and that here.
Yes, McDonald's Christmas was kind enough to give us this McDonald's Happy Meal ornament that came in an equally adorable Happy Meal box. So
each alderman got that from McDonald's?
That's right. All right. Yes.
It's really nice. And did Popeyes give any chicken sandwiches?
They did not.
All right. Well,
that would have been great,
how about
though.
How about Popeyes? That 14th Ward Burger King? Did they give anything?
Popeyes chicken sandwich. We have a guest comes on the show once a week, Miles Kampf-Lassen, who's he's written many funny, actually very compelling articles about Popeyes and their chicken sandwich. All right. So more important than the Christmas gifts was the fact that we had what I called, we talked about this extensively in the show earlier today, the Great Reefer Revolt at the Chicago City Council. And you were breaking news on our show. We were doing the show live, and you texted me while in the air. Am I on today? Yeah, you're on. By the way, what happened to the Reefer Revolt? And you pointed out that Lori Lightfoot, Mayor Lightfoot, quelled the Reefer Revolt, and so I broke the news. All right, so why don't you fill in the details and just explain to people what exactly I meant by the Reefer Revolt.
The Reefer Revolt. So the city of Chicago is set to have recreational marijuana come January 1st. The way that the state of Illinois rolled out who can receive licenses, existing medical cannabis dispensaries will be the first to receive licenses. So they've already received their licenses, assuming they have their inventory together, assuming they have their location together, they will be able to begin selling on January 1st. Then there's a certain number of licenses that are going to be rolled out in the months to come. And one of the things that the Black Caucus was very upset about is that not a single owner of any one of these dispensaries is African-American. Mm-hmm. Is a person of color. And we know the nasty history and racist history of the war on drugs in this country. We know the way that, you know, Black men, Black communities, and Black families have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. And so it is very onerous to think that here is an industry that was relegated to the Black market for years, where Black men were subjected to ridiculous levels of imprisonment, and now it's going to be legalized, and who's going to benefit off of that legalization, right? Rich white men. And so the Black Caucus said, we want equity. And they tried to work within the confines of zoning to try and create some tools for equity, but did not feel that that was sufficient. And so instead what they said was, we want to delay the issuance of further licenses in the city of Chicago for 6 months and take those 6 months to figure out how we can ensure that we have some Black ownership, some minority ownership in the cannabis industry, and figure out what's a policy that's going to promote equity in the city of Chicago. So we had the committee meeting. We had a subject matter hearing in the newly formed Committee on Contract Oversight and Equity. Mm-hmm. And there was a subject matter hearing a week or two ago. So there was no vote taken then. And then this past week, we had a vote. It passed committee. I think the final vote was 10-8. 10-9.
I think it was 10-9 because Riley came in and voted.
That's right.
Brendan Riley voted with the noes. So anyway, go ahead.
So it advanced now to the full city council today. And as Chairman Carrie Austin was reading out the report, she recommended that the ordinance putting a stall on the issuance and sale of recreational marijuana in the city of Chicago, stalling it for 6 months, she recommended that it pass with the first favorable vote from the Finance Committee, which means that there would have been no voice vote. And at that moment, Alderman Brendan Riley and my other seatmate, Alderman Gil Villegas, motioned to defer and publish, which any two aldermen can kick an item to the next city council meeting if they so choose. So that set off a series of procedural votes where in the end, the measure ended up failing by a sizable number of votes. Only 19 people voted. So there were a number of defections from the Black Caucus. Interestingly enough, almost all of the defections were chairs. Which, we kind of...
We'll take a time to break that out, what he means by that. But yeah. So 19 would, if my math is correct, and I was a young scholar at Evans in high school, Carlos, I would say it was 31 to 19, or was it not a full 50 at the...
There was not a full 50.
I see, yeah. Okay. So 19,
I think it was 29.
Oh, that's like old Harold Washington days, 29, yeah. a magic number.
And Gil was sitting next to me, and he is Mayor Lori Lightfoot's floor leader, and he's trying to lobby me during this meeting to vote with him, and I'm like, nope. And so finally, it doesn't pass. I'm like, see, Gil, you didn't need my vote. And he's like, yeah, but we wanted 30.
Hey, man, all you need is 26. Well, we'll get into that in a little while because mayors in the past, they get sort of irritated when anybody votes against them. You can't have a legitimate difference of agreement, you know.
Mayors and the president make.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, old boy Rahm wanted 50-0 for his first budget. Lori was 39-11. Now she got the website. We'll talk about the website in a little bit. We've talked, but let's go back to the reefer revolt. So, what were some of the arguments that Mayor Lightfoot put forth today to convince aldermen like yourself that the city did take seriously the issue, the fact that black entrepreneurs are not benefiting from the legalization of reefer? What were some of the compelling arguments that she made?
Well, some of the arguments were that the revenue generated by the businesses that are going to be operating come January 1st, part of that is actually going to go into a fund that will then help social equity applicants seeking to open up a cannabis business. But the argument that the Black Caucus would make in return was that by the time that, these funds had been generated and allocated, that there would be really no more licenses to issue, right? There'd be no more opportunity to really enter the market and develop your business. The other argument that was presented was that what the city was seeking to do potentially could trigger a lawsuit because there were a number of businesses that had already invested and that in effect there would be a takings argument, right? That the city, by pursuing this last minute ban or delay for 6 months, essentially, had a negative economic impact on these people and had taken something from them. Mm-hmm. And therefore, then a court potentially could strike down this ordinance and it would be for naught. But there were some gains. So, for example, the governor's administration was reaching out to aldermen and telling them, look, we will use rulemaking. So obviously the state of Illinois passed, legislation that lays out who can get a license, how this industry is going to work. So they said that they were going to use their rulemaking authority under the existing law to ensure that the remaining medical licenses only went to social equity applicants. So I think that that is a tremendous win. And that only occurred because of the Black Caucus standing together. And the Black Caucus is 20 out of 50 aldermen. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a significant victory. In the end, a majority of the Black Caucus felt that it was not enough. And they felt that this 6 month delay would still be extremely important to help the industry ensure that there was equity and that there were, blacks and Latinos and others that have been historically disenfranchised having an opportunity
Could
to participate.
Could you unpack that again one more time? What was the assurance? So, in other words, the city of Chicago had to turn to the governor's office, J.B. Pritzker's office, for a little assistance to address the concerns of the Black Caucus and yourself, by the way. You voted with.
That's right, yes.
What assurance did J.B. Pritzker's office come up with?
The assurance that came from Springfield was that through rulemaking. So the law has been passed. The legislation has been passed months ago in Springfield.
Yeah.
And now it's up to the state to administer that law.
Okay.
And so the commitment that was given was that through rulemaking, in other words, these are rules that now interpret the law, right, okay, that implement the law. So through rulemaking, the state would ensure that the remaining medical cannabis licenses that are to be issued would only go to social equity applicants.
I see. So, and what does social equity applicant mean?
Well, it's defined in the state statute, but essentially, folks that have been negatively impacted by the war on drugs,
right?
So, folks from the African American community, individuals that have been historically disenfranchised, and that would be a social equity applicant.
Okay. Well, I would take the lesson. By the way, was it enough to? It was not enough to convince you to vote yes.
Right. So, ultimately what I said, because I did get a call from the mayor's administration last night, and I said, look, I voted in solidarity with the Black Caucus. I voted in committee in solidarity with the Black Caucus, and my plan to vote again in solidarity with the Black Caucus, if they are satiated, right, if they feel like this is a significant win and they stand down, then I'm going to stand down with them. But, I think it was extremely important that the Black Caucus took this stand. It's rare that we see a caucus vote together. In the end, there were a significant number of defections, although the majority of the Black Caucus stuck together. I think that what's interesting is that some folks were comparing this to council wars. Mayor Lightfoot was asked about, is this council wars? I think she rightfully pointed out that a lot of the impetus behind council wars, which of course was Verdoliak, Burke leading a group of 29 aldermen in opposition to the first Black mayor of the city of Chicago. What Mayor Lightfoot correctly pointed out was that there was, a racist agenda, mm-hmm. right, behind, the opposition to Mayor Harold Washington. I think what's interesting here is that you have the first Black lesbian mayor of the city of Chicago, and a significant amount of the opposition that's coming to her administration came from this effort by the Black Caucus. So mm-hmm. I thought that's something interesting. It doesn't allow what occurred today to be filtered through the narratives of the past to say this is racist or this is some conservative tendency opposing the mayor.
All right, let me just deal with one thing. As the old guy who was alive for council wars, let me just deal with that one. Council Wars was an eruption by a white alderman and one Puerto Rican alderman against Harold Washington when he was first elected, against everything Harold Washington did. They wouldn't even approve Harold Washington's nominees. And the theory behind Council Wars, as articulated by Carlos's old friend, Richard Mell, Alderman Richard Mell, then of the 33rd Ward, was that in the long term, follow me on this, Carlos, the revolters of Council Wars would be doing the city a service, this is how he viewed the world, by sabotaging the administration of Harold Washington and turning voters against him so that somebody else other than Harold would be mayor in 1987, which would be 4 years after Helms. So Council Wars was essentially a tactical move by white aldermen to do what, as to quote Donald Trump, have a coup. All right? That is light years apart from aldermen exercising their right and their responsibility to vote against an idea that the mayor puts forth. Just because an alderman opposes a mayor does not mean they have a knee-jerk opposition to that mayor. That's like saying, the five aldermen who voted against the parking meter deal were engaging in council wars. The mentality behind saying any opposition to the mayor's council wars right. is the mentality that says, you, Chicago, are nothing but sheep. Shut up, get in line, and do whatever the mayor tells you. Do you agree with me?
I think we should have a subject matter hearing where we bring you as a content expert.
Man, they wouldn't let me in the city council. Get him out of here. But I hear this stuff, Carlos, and it just...
And I think it also shows just how out of whack our democratic institutions have been in the city for such a long time, right? That if you oppose the mayor on something principled, suddenly it's personalized. I can't tell you the number of times under Rahm and now under Lori that I've been asked by reporters, do you just personally dislike the mayor? I'm like, no, I'm very clear. Mayor Lightfoot and I introduced, co-sponsored together, an ordinance today to strengthen the city's protections for undocumented immigrants. So to me, it's all about policy. It's all about principles. And so you're absolutely right. To have 20 Black aldermen come together with a handful of allies and say, we want equity in this industry. We want to make sure that the city of Chicago is slow walking this so that we can make sure that there is black ownership in the cannabis industry. That is light years apart from council wars. And it's actually what a healthy legislative body should be engaging in.
And what it also shows, and this is why mayors really don't like it when there's opposition, it shows, as the teachers just showed with their strike, Carlos, that when you stand up for something, the powers that be sometimes have to make concessions. And that's why mayors don't like...
Do you know who Sarah Nelson is? Oh, you should look her up. She's phenomenal. Right. She's amazing. Yeah. Sarah Nelson, she is the head of the Flight Attendants Union.
I don't know her, but I know who she
is. Yeah. And one of the things that she's going all across the country right now talking about the way that the flight attendant unions flex their muscle, right? To basically end the government shutdown. I don't know if you remember
that. Yes, I do remember that, yes.
And what she said was that, what she consistently says is, using power builds power. Exercising power builds power, right? Mm-hmm. So when you flex that muscle, when you use that muscle, you help grow that muscle. And of course, mayors hate that, right? Yeah. Because they want to have absolute power. That's a natural tendency to say, hey, I don't want to have people that I have to consistently be negotiating with. I don't want to have people that diminish my power. You know, that is a natural instinct in some ways. So I understand why mayors, you know, don't want to see people flex their muscle. But I'm always of the opinion workers should go on strike. If you have the legislative power to do something and it's a principled stance, do it, whether that's deferring and publishing the ordinance, whether that's, you know, voting as a block. That helps build your power and makes you stronger for future fights.
Yeah, no, and then just to go finish out the analogy, what Carlos was alluding to was when there was the budget impasse and the government shut down. This is about 2017, 2018 with... in the Trump administration, good God. And the flight attendant, the air traffic controllers weren't working. So it was very dangerous. And finally, the flight attendants union said, you know what? We're not going to work. And I think the pilots were jumping aboard, just starting to talk about it.
It was going to turn into somewhat of a general strike.
Yeah, there would be a general. Yeah. And even Trump had to back off from that one. Point well taken. And here's another point. You may disagree with me on this, but I've been mentioning this all day. Look, I read all the arguments that Mayor Lightfoot advanced as to why it's so important to pass this legislation now and get the recreational reefer dispensaries open January 1st so the money can come in and the city can get its tax dollars. I hadn't heard that lawsuit argument, but all right. Like mayors have ever been afraid of lawsuits, but whatever. We'll pretend that's a legit argument. So I understand the argument. The argument they raised. I just want to point out that when it came to a casino in the city of Chicago, the same General Assembly that passed the recreational reefer law was the one that passed a law allowing Chicago to have a casino. And that casino, the proceeds would be divvied 30-30-30 between the operator, the city, and the state, roughly 30-30-30-30. Mayor Lightfoot said, no, upon a study, that was not enough money for the operators of the casino to make enough money to make it worth their while to run a casino. So she went back. She delayed the implementation of the law, went back to Springfield and asked them to change the law so that the rich guy who runs a casino could get more money. So I'm just pointing out that when it came to protecting the interests of the rich guys that run the casino, oh, it's okay to delay. But when it comes to protecting the interests of a black guy in the city of Chicago who's been locked up forever, ever for smoking reefer and white people get away with it, oh, no, we got to get it passed. I'm just pointing that out, Carlos. Am I unfair to point that out?
I have not thought about it that way, but absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said there.
That's the weird way my mind works. All right, now let's talk about something else that went down in the city of Chicago this week. I call it Flessner Gate. And this has to do with the lawyer, the corporation counsel for the city of Chicago. This is one of those bizarre, only in Chicago story, Carlos. So why don't you just, I've had a lot of fun with it. I'd love to hear your take on it. It turns out that the chief lawyer for the city of Chicago actually has a home in Naperville.
Yes.
All right, go explain this.
Yeah. Right. Well, so as your viewers may know, he has a home in Naperville. He owns a condo downtown. And he's been claiming the homeowners, the homestead exemption on both of those properties. So in other words, he's been telling the state of Illinois, he's been telling, you know, the county government that he should have lower property taxes because those are both his primary residences. Mm-hmm. Well, the question is, which one is it? And so the administration, the comms team for the mayor, in order to prove that Flesner indeed lives in the city of Chicago, they provided the press with a voter registration card from like May. Mm-hmm. And a driver's license issued in late May.
Okay.
What does that tell you? So here's a guy that was the treasurer for Lori Lightfoot's campaign committee. Mm-hmm. Did he not vote for Lori Lightfoot to be mayor?
I don't, even in the city of Chicago, I don't think they'll let you vote if you live in Naperville.
That, I mean, because the voter registration card was issued, I believe, if I'm correct, if I remember what I read, it was issued after the election took place.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, she wins the election and she's like, hey, guess what, buddy? We got to bring you in here as corporation counsel. We got to. So he goes and he changes his voter registration. And he. But to me, it's like if you genuinely live in the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
And this is your friend, this is your longtime coworker, confidant that is now running for mayor of the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
Don't you think you'd make sure that your voter registration is current in the city that you're claiming that you now live in?
Yeah. Well, my absolute favorite detail of Flesnergate. And by the way, let me just say this before I get to my favorite detail.
Oh, but now, so he's going to get to pay the money back.
Yeah. Well, it's time out. So he's going to. So in other words, he was the beneficiary of two homeowners exemptions.
Yeah.
And so you can only be the beneficiary of one homeowners exemption. He claims that it was. This is my second favorite part. He claims it was a mistake.
Which it could be. The point here.
He's a lawyer, isn't he? I mean, he's a lawyer. He's presumably the best lawyer in the city of Chicago.
I'm a very forgiving person. But,
okay. Yeah.
But the thing is, the mayor just last week was talking about how she didn't want to be lied to and how she wasn't going to, you know, allow any of this unethical nonsense to be taking place. But I think any person looking at this can now fairly say there's a different standard when you're her buddy.
Well, yeah, and yes, and I would make. I am now going to make an argument in defense of Mark Flesner. His first name is Mark, right? Okay, I've never met the man, so I don't know him. He could be the greatest lawyer in the world. Little weak on property tax law, but other than property tax law, keep him away from property tax law, Mayor Lightfoot. Great. He doesn't understand the homeowner's exemption, Carlos. It's really complicated. You can only have one. He got confused, okay? But aside from his weakness on property tax law, let's say he's a great lawyer. Let's say he's a longtime friend. And so she picks him. She wants to trust somebody. That's the guy she wants. This is what I'm like thinking about. Maybe I'm unfair here, but it turns out the Sun-Times did a deep dive investigation. He voted in 2018 in the Republican primary.
That's right.
I want to take you back to the spring of 2018. You had a choice. There was a Democratic primary for governor and a Republican primary for governor. The Democratic primary consisted of, let's see if I can do this, J.B. Pritzker, your good friend Danny Biss, Bob Diber, who Dennis voted for. Wish I had voted for him. Who else was in that
Chris
one?
Kennedy.
Chris Kennedy. How can I forget Chris Kennedy's greatest contribution?
Bob Diber from Carbondale?
No.
Downstate Democrat. Marine, Illinois.
Marine, Illinois, yeah.
He was the school superintendent?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
He was a nice guy,
He was a great guy. I wish I voted for him.
He's not dead. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And I always tell Dennis, you made the right vote. That's the guy I wish I voted for. I voted for Biss. I admit it. Oh God, do I hear it from Terry Cosgrove all the time because he was a huge Pritzker fan. Anyway, so you had choices, all right? And on the Republican side, your choice was Bruce Rauner or Jeannie Ives. This is a man who, when given the choice between taking a ballot that would enable him to choose between, let's say, Chris Kennedy, Dan Biss, and J.B. Pritzker, decided, no, I want to choose between Bruce Rauner and Jeannie Ives. I'm trying for the life of me thinking, what would motivate somebody to vote for either Bruce Rauner or Jeannie Ives? Help me out, Carlos.
I don't know. I'm not a Republican, so I wouldn't be able to.
Just so you know, I mean, that's like bad versus badder. I mean,
oh, yeah, no.
Jeannie Ives
Yes. I mean, I don't have that bad of a memory.
Genie Ives?
I remember Genie Ives' radio ads, the xenophobia, the right-wing, you know, policies she was staking out. And I remember Bruce Rauner running around in his, like, fake motorcycle jacket and his whole, you know, I'm just a regular guy shtick.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm hoping that now that Mark Flessner has left Leafy Naperville and moved to the Loop and is now dealing with many of the issues that a city like Chicago.
I think he read that he said that he's spending 4 days in the city and 3 days in Naperville.
Oh, okay. Wow. He gets okay. All right. At least the 4 days in the city, and that he's surrounded by people like Carlos and people like Jeanette Taylor and, you know, people of all different races and backgrounds and incomes, that he realizes that maybe being a Democrat would be a good idea. You know what I'm saying? I'm just throwing that out there. Anyway, that was my favorite.
And then the comms director for the law department was let go.
Yeah, I didn't.
That's
not,
how this.
Yeah, that's.
And allegedly, he was let go because I guess off the record. This is me reading in between the lines.
Go ahead. His name, Bill McCaffrey was his
name. Right, Bill McCaffrey. So off the record or on background, I guess he told someone in the press that his boss, the corporation counsel, did not actually live in the city of Chicago. Some could claim that's blowing the whistle.
Oh, that is that you reading between the lines, or is that something that you
I
heard?
I think that's what I read in Politico.
Oh.
That was what was being claimed over the weekend, was that he was let go. So that, because what the mayor said, she won't tell us. She says, I fired him for cause. But what she says is, I fired him for unethical behavior and unprofessionalism. And I've made it very clear that I'm not going to accept people either through omission or through commission, spreading mistruth and misinformation and lies. And I'm not going to accept, you know, people not treating each other collegially. She said something to that effect. And then when you read what is being reported in the press, which was that he had told folks, you know, that the corporation counsel, that Flessner did not live in the city of Chicago, what I view that then is he opened up his mouth about this, you know, residency issue that Flessner had. And in turn, you know, Mayor Lightfoot fired him.
Wow. That could be. I was not one of the reporters or writers that was rushing to his defense instinctively because I didn't know the guy. And I've confessed this on the air a couple more than once, Carlos. By and large, he served, McCaffrey served throughout the Rahm administration. And by and large, none of those people would ever respond to anything, you know, a call. And occasionally, I mean, get email responses. So I never had a personal relationship with any of them. Rahm was very much a mayor who people, it's like, if you were against him, that's it. You're off. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. But wow. That's a thing. By the way, I'm going to still put this out. Having said all this, and I get your reaction to this, I still think that Lori Lightfoot's a better mayor than Mayor Rahm. I still think, having said everything we've just said today's show, I don't even hold Flessner Gate against her on the grounds that, like I said, if this is the lawyer she thinks she trusts the most and thinks is the smartest and the most capable of dealing with the compelling issues that he faces, then that's her prerogative, obviously, as mayor of Chicago. So,
well, we'll strike one. Voting in the Republican primary. Okay. Strike two, messing up his property taxes.
Yeah, it's complicated.
We'll see what strike three
is. Okay. Anyway, but I still think that so far.
Yes, I think if we look at the first 6 months, absolutely. I think that, you know, the types of reforms that Mayor Lightfoot has been willing to put forward, her willingness to take on some of the entrenched power at City Hall, absolutely.
An improvement over Rahm.
Yes.
I mean, Rahm bowed down to Ed Burke and let Burke operate. Now, I have a friend. We have a mutual friend. I will not name her. But every time I say this in defense of Lori Lightfoot, our mutual friend, whose first initial is M, always tells me, well, Ben, that he was already indicted, so stop giving her credit for that. This friend is really hard on Lori Lightfoot. And I still give her credit for it. Yeah. I still think that that was an important moment, so I give her credit for
that. Yeah, and it just wasn't Burke. It was others as well. I think that, yes, the first 6 months, most definitely, I think we're going to have to wait to see, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now.
Right.
what the record really looks like.
All right. So that first budget, it went down since the last time we were on the show. It was right around Thanksgiving, I want to say. And the vote was 39 to 11 for the budget. You were one of the 11, correct?
Yes.
All right. Talk about that.
So I talk about this political Stockholm syndrome that I think developed. So a lot of my Progressive Caucus colleagues that are now in their second term with me, they were like, but this is so much better than what Rahm did. And the reality is that it was marginally better than what Rahm did, but it still was not the progressive budget that Chicagoans had voted for. It continued to rely on regressive taxes, you know, a rideshare increase. It continued to rely on a restaurant tax increase, which are regressive things that, you know, hit working people harder. It continued to rely on a slight property tax increase. It was obviously not the record-breaking property tax increase that, that Rahm had pursued, but it was there. And it also failed to include hundreds of thousands of workers in the $15 minimum wage by 2021 ordinance that Mayor Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle campaigned on the campaign trail. So, you know, at one point in time, I was leaning towards voting yes, because I said, hey, you know, this isn't the worst budget. And of course, Stockholm syndrome is when you're captive, right? And you become so abused and you begin to normalize the abuse and you begin to identify with your captor.
Yeah.
So the political Stockholm syndrome that I talk about is that, you know, so often we as progressives are so abused, we're so used to losing, that when we're shown just the slightest, you know, niceness, or just given the smallest little morsel, the little crumbs, suddenly it's like, oh, you're great, this is phenomenal, you know, things are going really well, and you begin to become enamored with your captor, with the status quo, with this broken political system. So we had a meeting as the Socialist Caucus, and we each went around, and my colleagues all spoke first, and they said, I'm a no, because this is not the budget that I was elected to fight for. You know, we put progressive revenue ideas on the table. We called for a corporate head tax. We called for a much more significant and aggressive TIF surplus. We called for institutionalizing TIF reform. We called for a pilot for big, you know, quote unquote, nonprofit institutions like the University of Chicago and Rush University, Rush Hospital. So pilot is payment in lieu of taxes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of big institutions that essentially function like for-profit corporations. We're talking about the University of Chicago, we're talking about Northwestern University, we're talking about Rush, and they have an extraordinary amount of property in the city of Chicago, much of it which they do not pay property taxes on. So the whole notion is that, you know, we're going to treat them like the big moneyed institutions that they are and ask them to help contribute towards the city's bottom line, because it is a symbiotic relationship. All of those ideas, despite being introduced in ordinance form, despite, you know, us pushing for them, lobbying for them, working for them, were ignored. And additionally, we also called for a real estate transfer tax. We called for a compromise that would generate money to address our city's debt obligations and pension obligations, but at the same time would fund homeless services and mental health services and public housing at the level that it needs to be funded at if we're actually going to deal with the housing crisis that so many Chicagoans are facing. So my colleagues were just like, this is not the budget that we were elected on. It continues to rely on property tax increases, regressive fees and fines. It does not make the meaningful level of investment that we need in things like mental health services and homeless services. So we're no's. And I was like, all right, I feel free.
I was going to go whichever way you went.
No, I mean, it's not necessarily I was going to go whichever way you went. But, you know, I think that it was liberating to have a cohort, to have a group of colleagues that you can say, yes, I can make common cause with you. Right. And after 4 years of oftentimes having been the sole no vote, you know, or one of a handful of no votes, to now have a group of people that say, actually, Carlos, you know, your gut instinct is spot on. Mm-hmm. Right. This is not the budget that we should be supporting. And, you know, if you think about it this way, we don't get to grade from a scale of one to F when you vote. Right. You either give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
That's true.
Right. And so, you know, essentially you're either giving it an A or an F. And, you know, yes, is this an improvement over Mayor Rahm Emanuel's budget? It is. But is this the transformative change that Chicagoans and that our constituency sent us there to fight for? It's not. And so we're going to continue to fight for that.
And mayors tend to take it very personal. I mean, because I listened carefully to what you said. Think about this. The vote you have on a budget is the only thing you have to express your sort of your worldview as to where Chicago could go. And when you know, because, you know, you talk to your colleagues, you know the budget's going to get passed. So the issue is, will it get passed 38-12 or will it get passed, 37-13? My math's all off, whatever. 39-11 or 38-12. There we go. And you decide, you know what? I'm going to make a statement. I'm going to make a statement about where I think the city should go, and I'm going to be voting no. And for a mayor to get offended by that, it's a sign that the mayor's taking it very personal, because it's well, the mayor won. I mean, you know what I'm saying? The mayor got her budget passed. Mayor Rahm got his. Weren't the votes at the end with Mayor Rahm about the same, like 10 votes no? Is my memory correct about budgets in the last couple of years of Rahm? Was it about 9, 10?
So Rahm Emanuel's first budget in 2011.
50-0
Was 50-0
Yeah, but by the end.
By the end.
When you were in the council, like 2018's budget.
I think the most was 15 people voting no. That was the year of the massive property tax increase.
Okay.
So that would have been the 2016 budget.
So there you go. And you were one of the 15, right?
Yes, yeah.
So I just feel as though it's really all you have. Now, it's a different thing if it's 24-25, you know, and then you really have to decide which way am I going to go with this, you know what I'm saying? But it's either what, 39-11 or 40-10, you know, what difference does it make?
I think one, for a very long time, the way that Daley and Rahm operated was, you know, if you do not vote with my majority, then I will not lend the support of my office, of the administration, of the executive branch, towards the things that you need to get done in your district. Imagine if Donald Trump, you know, told your local congressman, right, if you do not vote for, if you vote to impeach me, the mail's not going to get delivered in your congressional district, right? And unfortunately, that is the fear, right, that a lot of aldermen have. And it's not as bad as it was, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. But, you know, one of the things, so when I ran for office, I ran on a platform that said that at a city-owned parking lot next to the Logan Square Blue Line stop in my ward, I would support 100% affordable housing. I would support the community's proposal for a 100% affordable housing development to replace that parking lot. And it took me 5 years to finally win this, because every step of the way, the mayor and his administration would either block it or slow walk it. And at the very end, what I was told was, well, you know, they really don't want to give this to you because it's you, right? They don't, my ward desperately needs affordable housing, right? But because I have been a critic of the mayor, now they're telling me the Emanuel administration isn't going
who,
to.
Now, when you say they, who, with, you may want
it's legislative aides, it's other elected officials, it's people working in nonprofits that are working on this project. So there's just a number of conversations taking place.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
In your humble opinion, do you think they were telling the truth when they said it was personal against you? Or do you think they were using that as an excuse to cover up the fact that Mayor Rahm didn't want to sign on to an affordable housing project?
I think it was both. Yeah. I mean, it was very clear. I mean, I remember there was one meeting where Reifman, who was the commissioner of Department Planning and Development, you know, I've been telling Department Planning and Development, this is what my community wants to move on. So we set up a meeting between community stakeholders, between a nonprofit affordable housing developer, Bickerdike, which is developing the project. And prior to the meeting starting, the commissioner of Department Planning and Development comes in and says, can I speak to you outside, Alderman, for a second? And he goes, do you really want to do this? And I'm like, yeah, that's why we're here. And this is why I've been pushing for this meeting for months, to get the ball rolling on us talking about this development. And he goes, well, you know, wouldn't you think about, like, you know, there's an interest in putting an Amazon store there. You know how they have, like, those little Amazon stores that they're opening up across the city? So he's like, so why don't you think about that? And I go, well, you know, we want the 100% affordable housing.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I think it was a combination of both. But the implication there was that, you know, if I were a person that had voted 100% of the time with the mayor, that perhaps I would have had more chips to cash in, right? I would have had the ability to say, I voted with you 100% of the time, and now this is really what I want, so give it to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this is a tough one for, this would be a great debate on ethics. What was the prevailing reason for the opposition, the real reason? I'm leaning toward a knee-jerk opposition to anything resembling affordable housing in a rapidly gentrifying part of the city like your ward. And the only thing I could think of...
I will say, to Mayor Lori Lightfoot's credit, so prior to her being elected, she marched with community groups. We held a rally. 500 mm-hmm. of us marched through Logan Square.
Mm-hmm.
She was there. She supported on the campaign trail. And since she's taken office, her administration has been extremely supportive.
All right, so there you go. But what did I just say? I said she's better than Rahm. I said that.
And I agreed with you know? Yeah.
I mean, but it's not going to keep me from making fun of Flesnergate, which is absurd. There's like a million Democratic lawyers in the city of Chicago. You had to take one that voted for you to rot her eyes. Just kidding. Flesner, come on. Come over. It's never too late to be a Democrat. But
do you think he voted for Jeannie Ives or Rauner?
That's a great question, Carlos. I got to think about it. I'm going to put myself in the mind of a voter who's going to pick that ballot. So, okay, folks, just so you know this, we have listeners who are outside of Illinois. In Illinois, you don't have to declare a party allegiance until you walk into the polling booth and you to say, I want the Republican ballot or I want the Democratic ballot. So, as again, this man... like every voter in the state of Illinois was given a choice. He could take the Democratic ballot, and that way he could choose between J.B. Pritzker and Chris Kennedy and Bob Diver, et cetera, so forth, Danny Biss. Or he could take the Republican ballot and choose between Bruce Rauner and Jeannie Ives. Bruce Rauner was an extreme right-winger on economic issues, a vile opponent of union and collective bargaining rights, prevailing view of government is that we would be a better society if we could destroy the collective bargaining rights of workers. And he, to force the state to destroy collective bargaining rights, was willing to block any budget, any funding of government. He also kind of believed that we'd be better off as bankrupt state if that meant we could kill unions. So this was a man who I best say is a nihilist when it comes to government. And the state just broke down under his reign. There's no compelling reason whatsoever to vote for him if you believe in a functioning government. On the other hand, you had Jeannie Ives, who thought he was too liberal.
Yeah. on immigration, on abortion, on gay rights.
But supported him on his anti-government. So it's like, so you can make the best argument you can make for Flesner is that he was voting to keep Jeannie Ives from being the nominee. But then I would come right about and say she would get annihilated.
And every poll also showed she had no chance.
Yeah.
I mean.
So there's really no justice. So I don't know. Maybe he said, yeah, I really like Jeannie Ives' stand on gay rights. I think I'll vote for her. Remember, she was like the most virulently anti-gay rights person in the in the state of Illinois for a while. So and abortion rights.
Yeah.
So there's really no winning interpretation of this one. So I don't know. Anyway, but having said all that, kudos to her for supporting your initiative. So there.
Yes.
All right. Saying nice things about Lori Lightfoot. All right. And let me see. Before we move on, anything else I wanted to ask you about on city politics? No. I think we've covered absolutely everything on city politics I want to talk to you about. Let's talk a little national politics. As I said earlier, Carlos will be at the Hideout first Tuesday in February representing Bernie Sanders against Brandon. He'll be debating Brandon Johnson. It's going to be a great show, folks.
It's going to be amazing.
It is.
Buy your tickets now. Nah. I don't know if they're up for sale. But
any trash you'd like to talk towards Brandon
Lots
Johnson?
Of trash.
All right. Would you like to?
I've brought a truckload of trash.
Send a message to Brandon Johnson right now.
I mean, to be honest, I think you should probably line up someone from the Pete Buttigieg or Biden campaign as a backup, because I don't know if Warren's going to be in this race much longer.
Talk is already we'll get beat. It's really hard to find. Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden's. I would have to be the Joe Biden guy. I'm the closest comes to a Joe Biden supporter in this show. That's actually not true. We've had some Joe Biden supporters, but I think Elizabeth Warren will still be. I know you've made that joke before, but I think she'll still be in the race come February because the Illinois primary is not till March, correct?
That's right. But, I mean, you know, she has to do well in Iowa. She has to do well in New Hampshire. So we got Iowa, we got New Hampshire. We've got, is it South Carolina and then Nevada, or Nevada and then South Carolina?
I can't remember.
And then we hit Super Tuesday. And so right now, it looks like Iowa and New Hampshire is a race between Bernie and Buttigieg. And then you get into South Carolina and Nevada, and it's a race between Bernie and Biden. Mm-hmm. And then you hit Super Tuesday, and you got a lot of states that Bernie did very well in last time around. And then the biggest state of them all, California, is now on Super Tuesday. And it looks like Bernie's on track to win big there. Bernie is leading amongst all the key demographics that a Democrat needs to win in order to win the White House. Voters under 40, overwhelmingly with Bernie. Voters of color with Bernie, Latino voters with Bernie. So I do not see where, the Warren campaign goes from here, right? I think what the Warren campaign was banking on was really Bernie's campaign and his ability to campaign collapsing, right? And Warren then rising up as the kind of progressive alternative to the more establishment candidates like Biden and Buttigieg. If you look at the polling, voters that right now prefer Biden, their second choice is Bernie. Voters who prefer Warren, their second choice is Bernie. And so I really think that there's an argument to be made now that, you know, Warren is playing more so the role of progressive spoiler right now. Because mm-hmm. if Warren were to drop out the Iowa caucuses, let me tell you, Bernie wins Iowa. It looks like he's on track to win Iowa right now. If Warren drops out of New Hampshire, Bernie wins New Hampshire, and picks up votes everywhere else. My message is Elizabeth Warren, for the good of the party and the progressive movement, I think you should consider dropping out.
I'll deliver that to Brandon. I think he's coming on the show tomorrow, so I'll deliver that message, see how he responds to that. I have seen it. Somebody wrote an essay, and I wish I could remember the person's name so I could give him or her credit, because it was a compelling essay.
Was it Pete Buttigieg's high school essay?
No, we talked about, we'll get to that.
Award-winning. It is an award-winning
essay. Pete Buttigieg, what a trip. I can't remember where it was, but they didn't talk about Bernie Sanders. They didn't talk about Elizabeth Warren. They talked about a candidate named Sanders Warren. And the point of the writer, and I wish I could remember his or her name, is that when you add their numbers together, they're close to a majority, if not over a majority, a clear majority of Democrats in this coming election year for somebody who is lefty, liberal, whatever you want to call them.
That's right. But a sizable chunk of, a big reason why Warren has dropped so precipitously in the polls is because a lot of her white professional base prefers Buttigieg over her right now. And so while it is true that a majority of Warren's supporters prefer Bernie as their second choice, mm-hmm. there's still a sizable chunk that will not go for Sanders and will support someone like a Pete time and time again.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's get your thoughts on this. I've been putting this out to my guests, and I've been thinking a lot about this in light of Hillary Clinton's appearance on the Howard Stern show and the things she said about Bernie. And comments that Rahm's made, et cetera, and so forth. And Obama's, you know, the word is that Obama's may, urge people not to vote for Bernie. I've seen that thrown out. I've never seen it from Obama. I've seen it thrown out. Push comes to shove. The way I phrase this is this, Carlos. For years and years and years, lefties like me have been told by centrists like Rahm, shut up and vote for whoever we nominate because it's better than the Republican. And I've been doing just that. Okay.
Same.
All right. Okay. And I've been doing that. I'm older than you, so I've been doing it for longer than you. All right. But that's how
and
I
that's how
it.
You get that political Stockholm syndrome.
I really do love Bill Clinton more and more. So I go, all right, well, is the same going to be for the other side? Okay, Rahm's. Okay, Hillary's. Okay, Billy Clinton's. Let's say Bernie's the nominee. Are you going to shut up and vote for Bernie? And more I'm thinking, they may vote for Trump.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really scary to think about, like near a tandem. You know, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, but she's the executive director of Center for American Progress. Mm-hmm. And she just hates on Bernie Sanders all day. And it's just like, you know, what is someone like Neera going to do if and when he is the nominee? Because right now, if you look at the fundraising, if you look at the enthusiasm, I mean, 71% of Bernie Sanders voters say that he is their choice, right? higher than any other candidate by double digits, mm-hmm. right? Biden is next, like in the 50s, right? But the point here is that, you know, will they vote blue no matter who, right? That is the ask here. And it's scary to think that, some of them will not. But if you look at who have been the successful Democratic presidential nominees in the last 50 years, consistently, it has to be, or not the last, going back, consistently, they're nominees who excite young voters, who excite voters of color, and who change the electoral map, right? And are able to have big turnout in constituencies that normally don't turn out. If you rely on white professional voters, Republicans win every single time. And so when you look at the appeal that, older white voters, you know, the appeal that Biden has with older white voters, when you look at the appeal that Buttigieg or Warren has with the white professional voters, ultimately, you know, what I see there is a lack of enthusiasm from young voters and voters of color for those candidates, right? And Bernie has those voters. And so to me, if you want to have Donald Trump serve four more years in the White House, nominate Biden, nominate Buttigieg, nominate Warren. But if you really want to have a fighting chance where we not only take the White House, but fundamentally shift the electoral map for generations to come, nominate Bernie Sanders. You know, Bernie Sanders gets more contributions from military, active military members and military families than all the other Democratic candidates combined.
I did not know that. How do you know that?
Because I love Bernie Sanders. And every morning I wake up and I Google Bernie Sanders news.
Okay.
I thought you know absurd things about the Bulls. You love the Bulls.
That is really, that's, yeah. I
and then the algorithm figures me out, and then it's just constantly like, Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and I got some listeners. I have too many, Benny, you have too many Bernie bros on your show, and I'm reaching out to other candidates as well. I voted for Bernie in 2016. I always admit this, and I always point out, I did it fighting the conventional wisdom. Carlos has heard me in this subject so many times, of every baby boomer I knew telling me he can't win, and boomers lived under rules that were created in 1972 in their mind when George Montgomery lost to Nixon, and that's when Bill Clinton came to the conclusion that you could never be left of center. You always had to either be center or right. That was the only way Democrats could win. And that's been the prevailing wisdom of the Democratic Party ever since. Every single candidate since 72 has run from the center. No lefty has ever won the nomination for the Democratic presidency. And what I've seen in presidential race after presidential race, Carlos, is the candidate move to the left at the end. When usually when he or she was like, I could go through Fritz Mondale in 84, moving to the left, trying to get Mike Dukakis in 88, moving to the left. Now, oh boy, Clinton was lucky because he had Ross Perot in the race, who took the votes for from George Bush. So this would be a real challenge for the Democratic Party. This would be like going, finally saying we have that McGovern curse off, and we're going to move forward with a candidate, a lefty candidate. That would be remarkable, and I don't know how the establishment would treat it.
There was an interesting article in Politico that came out a day or two ago, and they talk about, they're like, you know, people in Washington, in the Beltway, they're always talking about, you know, Bernie, there's no way that we'll ever have a presidency. But given the polling, maybe we should start talking about what that might look like. And they have this cartoon that they drew with, like, the potential cabinet of Bernie Sanders, and you have like, it's like the White House, it's the Oval Office, and there's like a poster of like the IWW, the International Workers of the World, and then like Cornel West and Elizabeth Warren are like dancing on a table, and Bernie's like in jeans and like a blue like shirt, like with his like fist up in the air giving some speech. I mean, I really think that in the last several days, you have begun to see the mainstream media and the corporate media begin to talk about, okay, what really happens if Bernie's the nominee and if Bernie wins the presidency. What Politico kind of ended up saying was, you know, it's going to shift the discourse in D.C. to the left. You're going to see a lot of the harm done by Trump being undone, but we don't think that we get Medicare for All. And I think that's where they're fundamentally wrong, is that Bernie Sanders is not afraid to continue, sort of similar to Trump, right? Trump has continued to do the political rallies where one of the reasons why Trump right now is so inoculated from this impeachment is that he has that Republican base in lockstep with him. Even if they hate the man, even if they think that he's like the worst thing for this country, these Republican congressmen and senators are not opening up their mouths. They're just repeating the Donald Trump talking points and following his madness, because Trump knows how to exercise power. Right? For better or for worse, he knows that if he goes and rallies in a Republican district, he will turn out the base. He will energize the base. He will keep that party with him. Bernie Sanders similarly understands that, you know, you got to go out there and you got to take your message directly to working people. And I think that what Bernie would do is he would, for example, let's say there's a blue dog Democrat somewhere, right? That's like, I'm not going to vote for Medicare for all, right? I can see a President Sanders hopping on a plane, entering that district, having a rally with 20, 30,000 people saying, no, we're going to do Medicare for all. And then the party falls in line.
Yeah. Wow. I have to see that to believe that on the Medicare for all part of it. But you make a very compelling point. Donald Trump, all the rules were broken in 2016 when Donald Trump was elected. All the rules, he's continued to break every rule there is.
This is also what the Democratic consultants don't understand. We are living in the first WrestleMania presidency.
Yes. We talk about this all the time. Absolutely. He learned everything he did from the World Wrestling Federation.
Right. And people are like, oh, but why is Bernie yelling all the time? He's a yeller. It's like, we need a yeller, folks. Like, you're talking about reaching middle America. You're talking about, you know, reaching blue-collar voters. You need someone that's going to go on that debate stage and point that finger at Donald Trump and yell in his face. And working people are going to love it.
By the way, the debate is tomorrow, and I'll be watching that. We'll be talking about that debate on, well, if the down the people watching on the live stream, we'll be talking about the debate with Letizia Wallace and Samina Mustafa on Friday. But the one thing I just brought back a memory when you said that thing about Bernie yelling. You have these debates. There's 10 people on stage, 12 people or whatever, and so it's been a while. Like Bernie will have said something, and then I don't know. It seems like 20 minutes will have passed. Other people will be talking. And I would figure that somebody, he would have calmed down. When they come back to Bernie,
yes, yes.
Dude, man.
He's like, you're making him sound like a howling old dog. He's like, ah.
Yeah, you're doing him no justice.
All right, let me hear
this. I wrote the damn bill.
He's got the best Bernie. I wrote the damn bill. All right, final question for you. I've asked everybody this question. I'd love to hear your theory in this. I can't find a millennial, and it may be the millennials that I hang with, who is voting for Mayor Pete. And he is a millennial.
Oh, God.
And the other hand, and I know tons of millennials who are voting for the oldest guy on the running, Bernie, who just had a heart attack. So every millennial, most millennials I know are for Bernie. No one is for Mayor Pete. The only people I know for Mayor Pete are boomers. Like, oh, he's a nice young man, you know, and that kind of attitude about him. So what's your theory? Why has your generation not been drawn to your generation's first viable presidential candidate?
He's not my generation. The Millennial Caucus disowns Mayo Pete. We want to trade him for Bernie. There was a really good article in New York Magazine that talked about, it was titled something like, Why the Internet Hates Pete Buttigieg.
Oh, I saw that.
I sent that to you. And I think that does a really good job. And so what it talks about is that Bernie's young voters evolved out of the Obama base. See, I was big for Obama in 2007, right? I'm ordering the online packs. I'm out there knocking doors. I did such a good job knocking doors. I got one of the, you know, golden tickets, one of the tickets to be one of 70,000 people in Grant Park to hear his speech. Had to go through five different levels of fencing and security to get there. And then what we saw was compromise with Wall Street. What we saw was a rightward shift from the progressive rhetoric that we heard on the campaign. You know, we didn't see immigration reform go through. You know, instead of, you know, this push for universal health care, we end up getting, you know, a Republican policy from the 1970s that promotes our broken, you know, health, for-profit and health insurance industry. On issue after issue after issue, we were so disappointed. And so to now see Mayo Pete come forward and kind of just repackage all of that. Yeah. It's just like, we've been through this already. We're too jaded. And we don't believe you. And I think, too, one of the great things about, you know, Pete Buttigieg is that he's flip-flopped already so much just in the course of his, you know, 6 months on the campaign trail. He comes out and announces his campaign for presidency with the most full-throated support for Medicare for All. And then he begins to receive money from the ultra rich. And suddenly now he's repeating healthcare, for-profit healthcare industry talking points attacking Medicare for All, right? Repeating right-wing talking points attacking public benefits like free college and college loan forgiveness for all. So, I think that, you know, Pete almost seems like a candidate from like 10 years ago. So what the article actually said, it had a really great line. It was like, it's as if like Pete tripped into a chasm on his way to go vote in the 2010 midterm and just came out of the chasm now to find that all his friends were like into socialism.
Yeah, I saw that was a good line. I thought that was pretty good. I always say that Mayor Rahm made the mistake of buying stock in the charter school movement, political stock, at the very time it was tanking. He paid a high price and then it tanked.
That's right.
And it
hurt him with white parents. It hurt him with a lot of middle class voters who said, charter schools, that's not an option for me.
Yeah.
And I think similarly right now with healthcare, the healthcare industry is trotting out this argument around choice. Right? You get a choice around your healthcare coverage. In reality, you do not get that much choice, right? Because you can't go to a doctor out of network. Otherwise, you have to pay up the ass to do it, right?
I just have to say this. The utter inconsistency and hypocrisy of the arguments that centrists have positioned to turn people against healthcare. Follow me on this. Just been reading these books about Obama's first term, and they're talking about the bailout of the auto industry and how he engineered massive amounts of loans for the big car manufacturers to keep them from going bankrupt. And in talking about the situation they were facing, they were saying part of the reason why the auto industry is in such a dire state back in 2010, follow me in this, Carlos, is that they had baked into the cost of every car, and that's the language that Obama's people were using, baked into the cost of every car was the health care for the employees. So as part of a provision to bail out the auto industry, they forced those unions to agree to health care costs. Okay, that was the argument then. Now I'm watching Democrats on stage saying, defending against going to Medicare for All on the grounds that the unions negotiated for these health care. I'm like, you guys will say absolutely anything.
Yeah. And the truth is, too, is that anyone that's ever been involved in fighting for a strong union contract knows that the more things you can take out of the union contract and win legislatively, the stronger your hand as a union when you're fighting for increased benefits. Yeah. So if you don't have to worry about if the employer can't say, well, we can't give you a raise here because we have to pay all this here in healthcare, right? If that argument is taken off the table because healthcare is guaranteed as a human right through a Medicare for All national system, then you as a union have more ability to demand more in pension benefits, in pay, in vacation, and all the other concessions that you would seek to get from the employer.
Well, it'll be a tremendous stride for that. I believe that if the Democrats come out of their convention in Milwaukee next summer with a candidate advocating.
Can you imagine a Bernie Sanders convention in the city of the sewer socialists? The sewer socialists, of course, you know, ran Milwaukee for many years. They were all about socialism and very good public services.
Listen, man, it's one step at a time. We're only in December. We have the whole
primary season. Can you imagine just all the platter of cheese and all the PBR and all the millennials?
Millennials be loving
Chartoucherie,
that.
PBR, Bernie. It's going to be great, and folks. Let's make this happen, America.
And what's that millennial group I always tease Carlos about? The cigarette smokers.
Chain smokers.
Oh, chain smokers. I just tease
him. I think Pete Buttigieg is a chain smoker.
He's a chain smoker fan. Bernie's definitely Stevie Wonder, okay? And so is Elizabeth Warren. All right, you know, Carlos, it's a blast, but we should wrap it up. It's been a long time. So Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year, whatever you celebrate.
That's right. Happy holidays.
And Nick Spezzato will hit you over the head if he says Happy Holidays. He was in the show the last a couple weeks ago. Don't say Happy Holidays. Anyway.
I'm going to send the article where it talks about Happy Holidays is actually indicative of Christian hegemony. It's a very interesting argument.
I'm sure Nick will... Hey, Nick, that'll be coming anytime soon. Anyway,
that's where the woke people are at now, Ben. They're saying, don't woke. Even say happy holidays.
My president says, don't say woke. President Obama says, go back to sleep, Chicago. Anyway, Chicago woke. And I love it. I want to give a shout out to all those aldermen who stood up on Reefer Revolt. You got a concession. You got a concession. I'm going to buy your logic. That was a good concession and a lead to some black people.
It wouldn't have happened otherwise.
It wouldn't have happened otherwise. So I can give a shout out to Jason Irvin. All right. Give a shout out to Jason Irvin, the Pride of Joy of the 28th Ward, for leading that revolt. Carrie, how about Carrie Austin, your old seatmate? Didn't she sit
she's
next
still my seatmate.
Your
yeah,
seatmate.
She still sits next to me.
So I'm going to end the year on a positive note, a little independence from the black caucus and the city council. Got that change. Carlos, it's a blast talking to you, and we'll see you next year. Take care, everybody.